Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
Welcome to another Britflix.com podcast. My name's Stuart Wright, and today's guest is director Justin Doherty and writer Neil Fox. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you. Lovely to be here.
We're here to talk about your film, Wilderness. Does one of you, before we go any further, want to give us a brief synopsis as to what Wilderness is all about, please?
So Wilderness is a late 60s jazz romance influenced by John Cassavetes, which follows a couple in the throes of new love who head to the coast for a kind of weekend getaway, which turns out to be the first time their relationship is really sort of brought under the microscope and they find out things about each other that had previously not surfaced.
Other people don't matter to me anymore.
I feel the same.
Two people can also love each other and not be together because it's just a mess. I'm not sure if we're just gonna make a mess.
This is perfect, isn't it?
It's all I've ever wanted.
And how can people see the film?
The film's out there on various streaming platforms, including iTunes, you know, Apple, as it is now, and Amazon. And it's on a few other services, I think, isn't it, Neil?
Yeah, Sky, BT, it's now on Sky. Google. Yeah, so you can rent it from all of those places.
Cool. Well, we'll put a link in the show notes. People can do that easy enough if they so wish after listening to us talk about it. So what we're going to do, we're going to talk about the making of and producing of Wilderness. And it's a rare treat for me to be talking to both the writer and the director of a film. Often I get writer-directors on, but I don't get a chance to ask this question that often. How did you two come to be making a film together, and how did this, and from the kind of conception of the script?
Well, Neil and I have worked together on various projects from films to film festivals, theatre projects, comedy shows for the last 20 few years. We sort of met with it, you know, when I was both into directing and Neil was into writing, we kind of, with sort of the missing piece of the puzzle that we were hoping to find when we were in our late teens. And then it sort of went from there, really. We did lots of projects together, and over the years of running festivals and making short films, the one thing we hadn't really sort of got our teeth into was making a feature. And as lots of filmmakers know, you can procrastinate and sort of put things off because you don't have the right script or the right budget, or you can't quite get that third act sorted out or whatever. There's all that sort of procrastination. And we went through all of that, and a lot of our projects were, you know, slightly bigger films. I'm not talking sort of blockbusters, but they had, you know, substantial budget requirements until it got to the point where, you know, we weren't working together day to day anymore. Neil was teaching at the University of Falmouth, and I was still based in Luton, where we'd sort of grown up together. But we knew that our focus had to be on making a film. And we often incorporated teaching into our films, into our short films, and into our festivals. And we wanted to formalize that in a structure. And we thought, well, perhaps the one way is to create a simple, you know, we say simple, a teaching project where we have a teaching project, you know, feature film scenario, which we hadn't really seen before. And Neil had done a doctorate about film education and the relevance of film education. And we'd seen this gap, you know, out there in terms of, you know, what was offered and how further education created sort of filmmaking opportunities. And we really thought there was a nice marriage there of us getting to make something and teach at the same time. That's really sort of a scenario we always got a lot out of. And so we very much built Wilderness to fit that spec. We tried to keep it simple and in all those sort of classic Robert Rodriguez indie filmmaking lessons, you know, use what we had. We kept it small cast, and you use the environment we had around us to sort of create the story. And we got the idea of just of this simple story about a love affair unraveling and how to get from A to B with these characters in the story. And we thought, well, if we can tell that over 10 scenes with the actors and we can shoot a scene a day, then we have a film in 10 days, you know, in loose theory. And so that gave us, although we knew that would change and it would become more complicated than that, that gave us the kind of energy and the kind of framework to be like, okay, that's how the first feature will be possible. And we sort of went at it from there. And then Neil did a lot of the work at his end, you know, in terms of securing some financing from the educational perspective. And then we sort of, just rolled with it from that. So in conception to delivery, the film was sort of conceived, shot, and edited almost within a year, wasn't it, Neil?
Yeah, it's pretty close, I think. You know, we got the green light September 2015. And then, we were sort of, we had a casting crew screening sort of towards the end of October, I think, in 2016. And the film sort of was tinkered with after that, but that was pretty good in terms of from start to finish. And the script wasn't even written in the September of 2015 yet. So
essentially, this is a project that's been done with the university by you two, as it were, but in a sense, it also used a lot of student resources, i.e., they were making the film with you, but that was part of their education as film students.
Yeah, that's a really nice way of putting it, actually. I think it's been talked about and written about a lot, but it's quite complicated because it's easy, you know, most people just want to sort of say, oh, it's just it's a student project, which it is in part, but it's also part of a desire to kind of see what universities can do in a independent micro-budget space in British filmmaking, really. So it was always conceived as a professional commercial film, but that was, kind of housed within a university as much as it could be, that, deployed students as crew, but was both a teaching exercise and, you know, a kind of an addition to the British kind of independent film culture.
So essentially you brought in HODs that were pros and the students worked with them. So each student got to be a part of a different part of a production on the film.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Was that a natural process, i.e. there was obvious people for obvious roles in the film? Or were you having to divvy it up and people sort of almost like having to do what they were told and then that was their role on the film?
No, most people fell into the right space or the space that they wanted to be in fairly easily. We only had a few departments, as it were, like most, you know, micro-budget features. You know, you sort of cross over a bit in terms of what you had. So, you know, we had the, you know, we had directorial, we had, you know, writing, producing, sound, camera, and editing, and those were really the, you know, the you know, production, you know, heads, as it were, and a lot of them were crossing over in terms of the heads of department. And then underneath that, so we had a couple of students who assisted the editor, and they were with him sort of every day, you know, bringing in the rushes, or, you know, on set we were doing that as we went along, and to sort of give them a different experience rather than that happening after the filming had taken place. And then we had a few, and these are all second year students doing this role. And then some first year students were then on board as production assistants, and we tried to really vary their experience. So sometimes they'd be in the editorial, and sometimes they'd be alongside the camera, or to be fair, wherever they showed enthusiasm and, you know, were there when you turned around and needed something, that's where they were sort of doing it. It wasn't sort of an internship of, you know, going to go and get us some coffees, sort of thing. It was very much, we're going to get our hands dirty because it's 80% of us on this set are students, and you're going to have to learn and do everything. So if we've got to move, you know, if we need this job doing, if the boom needs holding by the sound department, you know, that's not something we're just going to get professionals to do. We're going to teach you to do it, and then you'll be booming that entire scene, or you'll be, on the sound recording end of it. And so we gave people proper roles, sort of make or break roles, really, because we believe that in trusting people that way, they step up.
And what was the relationship between the student's course and the outcome of the film? Was it directly linked, or was it just a nice to have kind of thing?
It was directly linked in the sense that those students applied to be on the film after, you know, to be in the department they'd just done a module in. So camera department, documentary for the behind the scenes, editing and sound, they'd all done that module, and then they applied to be on the film. It wasn't like an accredited module, but the idea was that it was an enhancement, and that these kinds of films that we make at Falmouth are ways of doing what you can't do in a classroom, sort of pushing out the film education offer that we have, so that students have opportunities to do the things that we can only really touch on in terms of theory, in terms of what, you know, actually building a kind of understanding of what a film production culture actually is.
Yeah, it's difficult really to theorize about the intensity of making a film, isn't it? Where time is money in lots of vocations in life. There are a few that I've experienced where once the clock's ticking on a production, it really feels like a clock's ticking.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think, you know, what was interesting for me sort of teaching film on a day-to-day basis was realizing once I was back making a film, because Justin and I hadn't made a film in about 5 years at that point, because I'd done the doctorate and then moved down to Cornwall. And all the things that I'd forgotten are just about being on set and being in that kind of final stages of pre-production. And that did definitely change sort of how I talked about filmmaking when I'm in a room. But yeah, there's a huge gulf between, you know, sort of talking about it and doing it. And the reason that we chose a lot of first and second years was because we wanted to have that, you know, that was from the university side, we wanted to see that learning from those students, you know, those students who really engaged with the process on the set and understood it could then come back into the course and be, you know, kind of advocates and sort of teach their peers how a film set is run. And that was really rewarding because, you know, that kind of fulfilled the brief then of doing something which really gets to the heart of filmmaking. And, you know, from our point of view, we've always had that aspect of it. And because we've always made films in Luton, most of the people that have worked on our sets have had very little experience, you know. So we were very used to working in that way with people who have this real energy to learn and energy to do good, but are kind of picking up as they go. And it's kind of harrowing in a kind of intense way, but it's so rewarding because it has a really unique atmosphere on the set, and just the feeling that everyone's kind of achieving this thing which no one thought they could before is just so wonderful to be part of.
Now you've been open, so this is another rare treat for me. You've been quite open about what the budget for the film is, which is circa 35,000 for this, which is amounts to sort of friends giving their time, private investors, students, and gear owned by the pair of you. So if you could sort of, and I think that's important people to understand, because that's a chunk of change for anyone. It's not a big chunk of change to make a film, but it's still a chunk of change to get your hands on to try and get a film made at any level, never mind with the students and stuff. So where did the core of the money raised for the film get spent?
I'd say, yeah, so that sort of 35 is sort of the figure we give out, because there's a point where we sort of stop. You should kind of stop counting a little bit after the film's finished. But there was sort of bits of post production and festivals afterwards and things like that. But that what that doesn't include really are the things which a lot of people might spend money on, like equipment and things like that. I have a lot of the equipment, and so we didn't spend anything on equipment. Mostly what that was spent on was the cast, and we spent money on the logistics. A lot of it was the logistics of transporting people around Cornwall, accommodating them, feeding them, and how we would do that over sort of a shoot of about 12 days. And so a core of it was that. And then there was a bit of money in post-production on music and, making the DCP and all those sorts of final things which rack up. But there's very little sort of spent in terms of on the screen, the production design, although it's sort of set in the late 60s, certainly in our heads. A lot of the production design wasn't that expensive. It's just a question of finding the right clothing and props and bits and pieces. But that was done quite thriftily. I think from memory that the biggest budget item was accommodation and food.
Which I think, just to dwell on that for a second, I think that's an important thing for people to appreciate, that if you've invested over time in equipment that enables you to make a film, then the human resource element brings with it a fixed cost that is largely unavoidable, isn't it? So you can, you can scale up and scale down depending on how big a cast and crew you want to be feeding and putting up for the night.
Yeah, I mean, because obviously we were bringing everyone away, so it wasn't, because the cast in our film, predominantly is two main characters who were on screen, in every scene, and so that they had to be with us for the duration plus some time in advance, and then there were a couple of supporting characters, and they were up for a portion as well, and we obviously, four of the kind of production staff had to sort of be there as well. So yeah, all that, but that we felt that was a really good sort of trade-off. We really believe in kind of comfortable sets with good food. I'm not talking, Michelin star deliveries of food onto the set, but just kind of, treating people well, especially when you're asking people to work for less than they might normally work and sometimes not at all. Feeding people and putting them up somewhere nice at the end of a day, being cold in the sea, there's somewhere warm to go. That's sort of, we've put a lot of value in that. And, we hired a motorhome for a couple of weeks, probably for nearly a month actually, to sort of take down there. And that provided, for the few thousand pounds that was for the logistics, that provided us a place to cater, a place to get changed. It provided our editing studio so we could run, Max out of that, have the editing department in there. It had a shower so we could get warm after we'd been in the water. It had all those sorts of things wrapped up in that. So the money was spent sort of quite sort of carefully, and it was spent in chunks. As a lot of who've done this, it all adds up. And mostly actually it adds up on festival submission fees and things like that. It's probably a few thousand pounds in submission fees there.
And that can be a real eye-opener, can't it, if you've not planned for it, that suddenly you're faced with a finished film and the route to an audience is going to cost you money you didn't put aside.
Yeah, there's sort of two things that we experienced with that. I mean, from a festival point of view, Neil and I run film festivals for more than a decade, and we often got letters asking for fee waivers because people said, I've spent all my time on the spent all my money on the film. And we knew all too well that sort of story. So we were very careful not to do that, because we know what it takes to run a festival and how actually submission fees are, if they're not extortionate, and some of them are, but reasonable submission fees, go to essential parts of festivals existing. And so we wanted that ecosystem to exist. And then the other thing was, yeah, just and the music, you know, what happens with the music after the film? Because, you know, we had extra costs in getting the music sorted out for its release on to the wider world through distribution, whereas we'd had festival rights for some of the, you know, tracks before, but we didn't want to spend loads of money on the music in case, you know, it was a dead fish and, you know, we've got this music license worth thousands that, you know, right, okay, is kind of okay, null and void. So we sort of had, we knew that, we took a bit of a leap of faith, hoping that that wouldn't cost us more in the second instance to then, upon release, get these tracks cleared. And mostly that worked out. But okay. Neil, would you say?
Yeah, I think that's pretty fair. I think that, the festival experience has certainly played into that aspect. I think when we sat down and, you know, when we scheduled it, we tried to shoot as much of it in order as possible for the actors' sake. But there are obviously kind of realities on that, you know. So one of our actors got a high-paying job, so couldn't come down at the time that we hoped. So there was a bit of rescheduling there. But when we sat down, a lot of it was about, you know, how can we give everybody, actors and the crew, the best experience on that day? So we looked at the... how, you know, where we were, what we, how we could cater, because a lot of the shooting was in quite remote places in Cornwall, so, you know, there was a logistical question there of how many people can we have on set comfortably that we can look after. And, you know, we got very lucky with the weather, but the weather in Cornwall is always very, very unpredictable. So, you know, it was a question of, you know, like trying to make a good experience so that whenever you came on set, it felt like we were being looked after to the same degree based on where we got to be. And, you know, we just did smart things like we found a place which worked as both a base for our actors and a location, you know. So you're always trying to think smartly about those things which have to cost money. Can they be, how far can you stretch it? And, you know, that while we think we learned a lot about shooting a feature that, obviously we had no understanding of because we hadn't done it before, we were able to bring through a lot of the ways of thinking that we'd used on festivals and short films to manage the production.
I mean it's purely coincidental, but I've over my time sort of covering film and the arts as a journalist, I remember back in 2008 I spoke to a teacher at Penkith School in Warrington who was the first high school to make a feature film called Louis. And more recently, I covered a film called Native, which was shot in Dagenham, although it was a sci-fi in a dystopian future where aliens come to Earth, but it was all shot in a disused Dagenham sports centre with a sort of Kubrick and spaceship interior. But the whole, a bit like yourselves, the whole of the people below the heads of department was all students. In fact, the director of Native was a teacher at a local school, and they basically turned the whole thing into work experience. So it wasn't even like it was a film course. It was just kids, media students interested in looking at film. It's not necessarily that there's an answer to this, but what from your experience working in education and in film, Why is this still such a sort of novel approach to sort of use the practical nature of making a film to help students gain real-time experience that they can put on their CV and walk out of college with, that's got some heft to it, really, when you can say, I've been on set for a film?
That's a big question, which has kind of occupied me for the last few years. And I've talked a lot about this to people at other universities when I've been doing research papers on this. It comes down to money. It comes down to institutions, you know, kind of being very careful about what they invest in. Film is a risky investment. It takes a long time often. Even, you know, I think even Wilderness, which was shot very, very quickly, it's still a year. And then before it goes out into the world, you know, and obviously that, you know, it's been 5 years, but so the how you frame the investment in terms of allowing the staff the time to do it and, you know, investing in the student experience beyond their course is a really it's a really tricky thing to do because there's very little precedent for it. There's very little precedent for it globally. A lot of the conversations that I've had, you know, kind of taking kind of bits and pieces from different places, including like Harvard's sensory ethnographic lab, which made the film Leviathan, the brilliant kind of whaling documentary.
Okay.
And sort of, you know, kind of putting together things like that and saying, this is how you can sort of do different types of production. But it's the one of the things I realized when I arrived at Falmouth was that it is quite a, it's quite a special place in terms of the department that I work in and the people that I'm surrounded by. It's a small arts university, which, you know, doesn't have a long history of any kind of research-based practice. So it's kind of starting from scratch. And a lot of places are bound by long traditions or, you know, kind of really ingrained ideas about what research is and what practice is. And I was very fortunate from doing the doctorate that I developed a language of being able to articulate how this investment was of benefit in so many different ways. It was a benefit to the students primarily, but it was a benefit to the university. It was a benefit to the sector. So it's knowledge exchange. It's a benefit to research because I get, you know, outputs out of it. Mm. It's a benefit to recruitment and marketing. You know, we have an open day with 100 students who've come from all over the country, and we put up behind the scenes on wilderness. We put up behind the scenes on bait, and we say, look, while you're here, you can get a credit in department for working on a feature film. Those 100 students want to come instantly, you know, so all of a sudden the £35,000 when set against 100 students' fees is absolutely nothing, you know. Mm. So there are ways of talking about this that are kind of, you know, where you have to be able to articulate it to the institution that's backing it in a way that they understand. And that's an ongoing conversation. It changes a lot. But most people don't know how to do that. And I didn't know how to do that. You know, my approach to it was instinctive based on my research, based on Justin and I's history of making work and knowing that there was a gap and knowing that students were coming out of universities. You know, we had students in Luton who were coming out of the University of Luton or University of Bedfordshire, as it then became, but also students returning to Luton after graduating who had no access to this kind of experience. And we knew that was something that universities weren't offering and couldn't offering. And historically that's been the case. So it's, you know, it was great for us because we managed to make this work and set in motion at Falmouth a kind of a real culture of doing it that hopefully we'll be able to tap into again. But it's complicated because ultimately it's about investment and no one really wants to invest in filmmaking, because it always feels like it's you're just giving money to a single person's artistic vision and you're sending them off to spend your money, which is never really attractive.
No, I could see there's that there's the struggling artist who's just going to exploit the school to make their art.
And another thing, it has to go the other way too. So, you know, you have to be able to find filmmakers, you know, and other, you know, supporters and partners and investors that see the value in doing a feature film with, you know, with a large educational aspect to it, because that's quite a risky thing to put across to anyone. Sort of say, oh, we're going to make the film, and you got your, you know, other people are going to put in little bits of money, and you sort of say, well, half of it's going to be we're going to be teaching over here, and suddenly you'll have people, you know, who might be concerned about that. So I'm sure that's a reason why it doesn't happen a lot, because you need your ducks to line up, and you just need to have people that are willing to take those sorts of risks and sort of see the benefit of it. And I think that's why Neil and I got to this stage of wilderness, is that we just saw this as, you know, we had to put our selfish goggles on for a bit and sort of see, this is a way that we'll get to make a film. And we don't know what that film is going to be like, but at worst, we'll come out of it and we'll have had a really good educational experience with some students, and we'll have done something that, you know, means something in that respect only. And if we'd have left Cornwall at the end of April like that, then that would have been that. But, you know, thankfully we got a film out of it that we quite like. And it did do that other thing, but you know that is a risk. You know, it's a calculated risk, and we just thought it was sort of, you know, worth the punt in a sense.
We talk a lot about Cassavetes in this regard, you know, and there is a kind of Cassavetes influence in the film, in the sense of trying to do something which is quite emotionally raw and, you know, kind of emotionally messy, and having that kind of deep exploration. But Cassavet is also a major influence in terms of our filmmaking, and that understanding of trying to get something made by sort of by the means that you have, you know. And as much as he had a very difficult career, much of his success came from his ability to convince people that he was going to, you know, spend their money in the right way. And that's a lot of what independent filmmaking is, an independent art. You know, you're trying to get little pockets of money from different places, and, you know, you're trying to do it with honesty, but it is at the root, you're trying to get people to give you money. And, you know, making films in Luton and running film festivals in Luton, that has always been a part of how we've had to raise money, because there has always been a real, you know, suspicion of giving money to people in Luton to do anything. And, you know, you do spend your time trying to work out, well, what can I say that I, you know, that will get us this, but also what do I want to do in order to get that money? You know, and I think that we got to the point where, you know, our life had reached the point where a feature was the logical thing and the kind of the thing that we wanted to do that we hadn't done. But our lives were radically different to what they were a few years previously. So it was about looking at that situation and seeing how can we make a film under these circumstances, which felt very Cassavetes like. And, you know, the legacy of Wilderness for me at work has been, you know, it's kind of propelled my career, because I've been able to, yeah, sort of showcase its success on so many different levels, but also, you know, sort of publish papers and sort of, you know, and sort of do conferences that have come out of it. So it's done everything we said it was going to do at the start. So I don't feel bad about the selfishness, you know, and I think that's, you know, I think that, and that faith that they've had has been repaid tenfold, which is why we're still making films at the university and kind of more and more exciting kind of developments in that regard.
One of our other heroes, Ed Wood, also did this.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Thing now.
He did, obviously.
to varied success compared to Cassavetes. But I was just going to say, one of the things about that notion of the relationship between the filmmakers and the money and all the resources that you get to make it, is that a lot of the times the risk is apparent to anyone coming in to be involved in a film. The very nature of a film getting made means there's a lot of risk involved. But from a stark relationship between the investor and the person, say, directing the film, is that they just want to trust that you're not going to waste the money. Because there's obviously, you can make the best film ever in critical terms, but it can still lose money. But if you just throw an iPhone round a bucket for 10 hours, you've not made a film, have you? So it's like, it's that kind of trust as well, in terms of the relationship between the filmmaker and whoever's patronizing it with money or giving it money or whatever, however it comes around. And the more success comes, the greater that is. I mean, a kind of easy example would be, only because I've just rewatched it, is look at Reservoir Dogs. It's made for tuppence. And then look at, you know, the later films, his career, you can see there's a lot more money being trusted in him, but the risk of making money from a film is still remains. It just, there's less risk attached to the person making it.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, it's about understanding what the investor wants for their investment. It's not always their money back, you know. Like at the university, for us, you know, it wasn't about making money. They needed to know that their investment was being returned in other ways, you know. And I think that's often the case. You know, you know, we don't have many tax breaks, obviously, in this country anymore. You know, that was a good source of being able to get money from people. But, you know, often, and we've done that with grants as well, you know, like what's the return of investment for the money that you're getting? And I don't think independent filmmakers necessarily think about that enough. You know, there's too much of an idea of, I just want the money because I'm a creative genius. I know that's not necessarily explicit, but it certainly drives, I think, how people approach getting money. And I think that, you know, we've always scrabbled around and I feel that that served us well as filmmakers, because we're just much more aware of that conversation. And it's a really important conversation, because there's so few ways to get money to make films, and feature films particularly, that you have to be smart about it.
If we can just talk about two of the main characters in it, and we'll start with casting James Barnes as a male black lead playing opposite a white lover in a period drama set in the UK. But in your film, there is no real overt race-related drama. I mean, there's arguably a little bit out on the beach early on, but it's not something that drives the film in any way. That's a really interesting decision to take, both in terms of the storytelling and just creatively. So what was behind that in terms of Wilderness?
I guess it's kind of colorblind casting in a way, in that Neil didn't write it with any particular, it wasn't written like that, was it, Neil? It wasn't written as a mixed race couple or.
So on the page, it didn't specify that James's character was a black man.
No.
And in fact, the scene on the beach it obviously reads on the scene where a landowner comes and he's clearly troubled by James's appearance, is actually something that happened to Neil, probably more from a class perspective than anything else. So it's actually that scene existed before James was cast too. So we never, that wasn't really the story we were telling, in a sense. Obviously, the fact we say it's a late 60s film, it raises the question, you know, more in a sense of like, what about, you know, British history and race relations? It, you know, raises that. But for us, the film isn't sort of like, we're not rubber stamping it in 1968 or 1969. It's just it's a feeling and an aesthetic and a kind of a creative kind of release to have that film sort of set and look like that. We're not really drilling down into the kind of what's and why's of anything like that. It's really just about, you know, two people, and those people could be two men, two women, and in this instance they happen to be a black man and a white woman. And so I think we weren't really interested in that element, and more about what the people were bringing about their own experiences in kind of, you know, love affairs and those kind of initial projections one makes on another person when you meet, and all that kind of, and all that unraveling. And I think Neil brought all of his experience with that to the script, and I brought my experience into the directing, and then James and Kat very openly brought themselves as well. And so it was always very much about that, as opposed to what they look like, and right or wrong. I think that's the sort of perspective we went down. Neil, is that right? I mean, it's a while ago now.
I think it's absolutely right. You know, that the reality of the process is obviously not on the screen. I think when we cast James, we knew that scene was going to have a different context, kind of undeniable. We'd had a similar experience on our short film, It's Natural to Be Afraid, which was the last film we made, where we'd had that in mind as an Eastern European female lead, because of what was going on in Luton at that time in terms of immigration and certainly kind of, you know, the reporting of Luton. We're very passionate about, you know, Luton being portrayed fairly and realistically, as opposed to the media portrayal. And we wanted to sort of, you know, tell a story. But then we cast an Israeli actress, and who didn't speak, you know, in the film, she didn't speak any English. So there was a kind of, that just automatically changed the context of the story, given her background and the fact that she was using, you know, Hebrew to speak. And so we were kind of aware that when those casting decisions have an impact,
I think they're more for the conversation afterwards, aren't they? I think we're interested in the conversation they bring, not.
Yeah, you know, I'm really interested how it reads, because I think that when, you know, I think there's a tendency, because the film's released in 2021, but was obviously shot in 2016, to, you know, to want to defend it in the moment, but I really just want to hear what people think about it, because I think at the time when we talked to James about the role, he was so excited that he was up for a feature lead, and it was a film role that wasn't a gang member or a drug dealer. And he said that explicitly, like, this is a role which you're seeing me for, which I would not, I don't get these kinds of roles. And I think that then casting someone, and they'd already read the script, because all of the people that we looked at on our kind of workshop casting day, they'd all seen the full script. I just felt like going in and saying, well, now we've cast you, let's make it more about race. It just felt really like I didn't have the experience or the desire to do that at the time. I didn't know James. I didn't know anything about him other than the reel and sort of the little bit we'd worked with him. So part of me felt like, well, you know, the film is not about that. Let's not just make it more about that because that's the way we've cast it. Because my worry was that then it becomes me writing, trying to kind of placate what I think is going to be the reception of the film, which is not a great place to write from. You know, and I think that talking about it, you know, I wonder what I'd do if I'd known James Moore, but I don't know. It was a long time ago. So I think that I'm proud that it's not overtly about that, and that it gives a really, really great black actor the chance to do something which is not defined by race. Although obviously it comes up in a, you know,
this is something I've discussed before. It's sort of, I'm as guilty of like my reading of the film as anything else, because I'm so used to seeing that become a red flag for the drama that I'm sort of surprised it's not. Whereas, you know, everybody who is not white, their life experience every day is not always defined by racial conflict. There obviously is racial conflict. There are racists. There's no denying that. But lives aren't defined just by that alone. And obviously he's a jazz musician. So a jazz musician in the 60s being black is neither here nor there, is it?
No, exactly. And I think, you know, he is, you know, there is the sense that the life that he leads is probably as insulated from those day-to-day traumas as you could have got at the time. Not to say they weren't there, but certainly, like you say, that, you know, traveling around cities with fellow musicians, you know, was a better existence than for most people, like you say, on that day-to-day basis. And the hope is that over the course of the film, there are a number of things that come up in different ways that put their relationship under the microscope, and that's kind of one of them. And how they deal with that is as telling as how they deal with anything else. So it's been really nice to talk about it, because it's something that I really believe in. And also, I mean, I think what's really nice is that, and I've sort of said this a couple of times, we've been really afforded the opportunity to talk about it in a way which I'm really grateful for, because I think you see online people's responses to things, and we could have been really attacked for this, you know, in terms of, you know, that horrible word discourse. But it's led to these really interesting conversations, and it certainly made me think about the writing of that story and the process of working with James in a way that I think has been really valuable. And I think the film coming out in 2021 is certainly, that would not have been the case necessarily 2016. It would have been a different conversation, because film culture was in a different place even 5 years ago about this issue.
But equally as progressive is the way that you've written Catherine Davenport's role of Alice, in the sense that she's someone with her own view of the world, someone with her own ideas of what's right and what's wrong. She's not, while she's with John, she's not defined by John at the same time. And she doesn't, as to kind of phrase, she doesn't take any shit. In fact, she sees what's going wrong with others and gets herself involved. It's quite the powerful role you've given that character of Alice.
Thank you. Yeah, that's really nice of you to say. I think a lot of it is down to Kat and James, I think. You know, part of the writing process was trying to leave the lines as open as possible so the actors could decide on tone, and the actors could decide on, you know, and I know that's certainly what Justin worked with them on, was, you know, was building that mood where they were going through that relationship. I was as interested in seeing their interpretation of, you know, what could be ambiguous based on their own experience. And Kat's performance, yeah, just kind of was just, it just kind of got to a place which I was really excited by watching it, even in the audition.
Yeah, because there's a lot of work for the actors to do, because obviously the drama is very much sort of room-based. It's not action-based at all. So you're relying very much on how much they can convince us this is really going on.
Yeah, and we were very fortunate. I mean, like, we mostly shot it in sequence, so we were able to have a kind of nice progressive, you know, journey with that and sort of see how that went sort of day to day as we were feeling. And yeah, but also I think, like Neil said, he left a lot of space in between. I mean, the screenplay is about 62 pages, so there's a lot of breathing space there where we could kind of create scenes or just leave spaces for them to just, you know, react to each other and have that. And I think they really enjoyed having that freedom. And you know, I enjoyed having that fun with them where we could do that. And we were able to sort of change the way scenes, you know, how scenes appeared, you know, so they weren't, you know, like you say, a lot of it's essentially in a room, you know, it's like a play, but we tried to put it into different scenarios where that sort of was masked in a way by what they were doing. And so I think, yeah, that, but what I think is always evident about the film, and this is always within James and Kat's reactions to it when they rewatch it, and, you know, they rewatched it again recently and sort of messaged me, is that the film is the sum of its parts, you know, it's because we made it pretty much in sequence, and because it's very much who we were in that month. And so when they come back to it, they kind of, you know, if we'd have made that film 3 months later, it could read very different, because it was all just very much going on adrenaline and energy like that. It was, you know, we didn't rehearse and re-rehearse scenes so we could get them to a fine point. We were very much reacting to the situations. Often we wouldn't have our location or have access to our location. So it was about, we created the scene in the moment, in the location, or we felt that. I mean, towards the end of the film, there's a scene where they play cards again, and that scene ended up just being a static shot because of the way it felt that day. And so a lot of it was improvised in that way, in the way that we wanted to bring the idea of jazz improvisation into the film. And a lot of the scenes or scenarios or framing of those scenes, they're repeated throughout the film. And so Neil gives me lots of, he writes in lots of moments where, like, it's almost like the same but different. You know, we're seeing above them, and they're talking about how perfect it is, and then we're seeing above them, and they're talking about how broken it is, and how we can repeat that visually and do a little twist on it, like you would take a jazz solo and slightly change the refrain. Or,
you know. Can you think of examples where James and Catherine did something or brought something to the character that you couldn't have imagined until they did it? That sort of, you know, because obviously there's one thing to read the character on the page, and then obviously there's another to begin to see it come to life.
Well, I think there's a scene after the scene we used for the auditions was a scene where they've been to a party, and it's where the bubble's really starting to burst, and they've, you know, alcohol has been consumed, and they're starting to sort of see things in each other, and certainly say things to each other which they might not mean or might most certainly mean, and they go back to there where they're staying afterwards, and the emphasis, you know, the sort of, you know, the emphasis on them is to have sex, because they're, you know, they're lovers, they're away for the weekend, that's what they're doing, this, that, but they can't help but continue this conversation, and you know, this was written as a conversation, and we put that into the framework of a kind of a love scene and a fight scene that are sort of combined, and that was where we really just talked about that scene a lot with James and Kat, but we didn't really get to see what it was going to be until we did it. So it was kind of all this build up, and then, you know, James, Kat, and I went into the bedroom, and we just sort of let rip all of that stuff that had been coming up. So I think that's where there's some stuff I just love in the film, because you know, it wasn't directed, you know, like that. I can't take credit for those bits. That's them just kind of, I'm just following what they're doing. And it was just nice because it gave them a lot to go on, because they weren't just having an argument. They were having an argument and trying to make love, and it kind of gave them a lot to kind of work on. And so it's sort of up and it's down within the scene. And I think they really sort of showed some great moments within that. So that's the one that definitely springs to mind.
Okay. And can you tell me the role and influence of owning a jazz club on the film?
Well, it was a handy convenience, really, wasn't it, Neil?
Yeah, practical. So only practical.
I remained in Luton, after Neil and I sort of, when Neil went to Cornwall, and I started a jazz club in a building here, and jazz wasn't sort of part of the film until we were talking more about Cassavetes, and we were, you know, Neil and I love soundtrack, and so we're always led by soundtrack. I mean, it's just part of it. It's part of the films we love so much, and so that was going to be important to us, and then we just sort of started talking about it from a creative point of view in terms of what that could lend to the film, and how it would be a nice nod to the Cassavetes, you know, tribute we wanted to do, and also just, you know, we have access, you know, from a practical point of view, I have access to a lot of, you know, great jazz musicians, you know, the best British jazz musicians play at this club, and so I had a nice, you know, soundtrack on tap, and people were really generous with what they gave to the film, and we re-recorded some pieces for the film, specifically, you know, the opening and closing credits, which is an Ornette Coleman track that Neil used while he was writing the film. Okay. And we had a great band re-record that. And again, that was a practical decision around the jazz club. We could shoot that opening scene in the club, so we could sort of see jazz, because it's a jazz movie with not a lot of jazz in it. In the film, you don't see people playing jazz, you know, in the movie. It's not that kind of jazz movie.
Yeah.
But people who like jazz movies seem to know what we mean when we say, you know, it's a jazz movie. But, you know, we were able to do that within the film. And we knew that Ornette Coleman, coming back to budget again, we knew that Ornette Coleman track would probably cost us a lot of money if we were going to use the Coleman recording of it. And so... and these great musicians, and we filmed them, so they're in the opening credit sequence, their fingers and mouths just sort of playing the instruments up close, and then we own the master of that now, so we just pay the publishing, and the publishers were really great with us throughout, you know, gave us really good price for having the, you know, the festival rights, and then the, you know, the further rights for release, and so that became a much, you know, much cheaper way in a way than, you know, paying for that track outright. So the jazz thing was, yeah, it became all sorts of influence, really, and it was sort of nice timing and sort of serendipitous that it worked so well with the film, because we weren't starting out to make a film with a jazz soundtrack per se. I think it just came about in Neil's kitchen one evening.
and it just helped the writing of it, you know, like, because it was quite early on and I'd started writing. So I had a kind of lot of it sketched out, but it didn't really have that mood that I always like to have when I'm writing. So the jazz thing helped. And then that period of jazz and that period of, yeah, kind of cinema and culture is something we're really interested in. So that's off almost where the period is located, is in the stuff I was listening to write it, which was Ornette Coleman, Alice Coltrane, John Coltrane and things like that. So yeah, that, And then, just the feeling of listening to that, and can we get anywhere near that through the making of the film is what drove it. And, you know, one of the reviews that I was most pleased was the Jazz Journal, because they got it as a jazz film. You know, they really understood how it was a jazz film, even though it's not, you know, loads of close-ups of James playing his sax and then laying with it mournfully. You know, there's a real kind of, yeah, built-inness to it, which is pleasing, I think.
In the writing of it, Neil, what for you were the biggest storytelling challenges once you started to sort of begin to write it out as a screenplay to develop? Because obviously you've got the two central characters, and it's their attraction, their repulsion that we're sort of watching. What for you was the sort of biggest storytelling challenge?
Resolution, really. The the need for stories to, and particularly screenplays, to have resolution, not just at the end, but kind of built in, you know, these kind of mini structures where you're constantly resolving things. And I just didn't want anything to be resolved. So kind of trying to stay conscious of writing and then getting to a point where one of them would say something or do something that would resolve even that fight, you know, and try to make it, you know, just push into the next scene, which is where a lot of the space that Justin sort of exploited with the actors came from. You know, that there's, it's not an easy kind of tied together script, and that was on purpose, you know, so that was conscious to be like, okay, well, I think because of it, a lot of it was personal in writing. I didn't want to put too much of me in there, and I think a lot of me that could be in there would be in that kind of, oh, let's just make this tidy and kind of make it easy for everyone to understand how everyone's feeling and that they're happy and they're going to be happy, you know. So that was a challenge, because I think the tendency can be to make it tidy, and I just didn't want it to be tidy. I wanted it to be messy throughout, so that people would come out of it confused about how they felt about it. And that's been great, because everyone's kind of confused about how they feel about each character at the end, you know. And that kind of, again, I think was great, because I think that Kat really saw an opportunity to do something fearless in terms of someone who was just interested in her own perspective a lot of the time, which you rarely see. And James, I think, doesn't get enough credit for not doing the obvious thing of being really strong and defiant, but for being quite vulnerable and unsure and a little bit pathetic at times. You know, I think that they played around in the mess, which was very rewarding.
And I think that element of it really resonates for the idea of the period it's in, because I could imagine that a young man with expectations of what a woman should and shouldn't be might well be thrilled and terrified at the same time by who Alice is.
Exactly.
Yeah, she doesn't really let him get away with any of his kind of normal artistic shit, really, does she? And that's sort of what if there was a sort of any note we gave her, that was sort of it, really. You know, he's never really met anyone like her before, and she is kind of, and that there is an enigmatic element to her, and that we don't really know anything about her, where she's come from, you know, what, you know why she's got this sort of strength, and why she just said, you know, she says the thing she says, you know, and sort of sticks the spoke in the, you know, sticks the stick in the spokes, you know. And I think that's what I love about what, you know, I love about her, really, and hate about her, and you know, have, and even Kat has this like love-hate relationship with her when she comes back to watch it. And I think going even back to the music, that's what makes the Ornette Coleman track, which we, you know, kind of knew he had to kind of find a way to use in the film and get, you know, have the permission, is that it really represents these two people. Like the Coleman track is messy, and it's uncomfortable to watch. And that's how the film starts. The film starts with this old style credit sequence for 3 minutes where you watch the credits and you hear this duel between a saxophone and a trumpet, and they're playing together, but they're not playing in unison. And you know, they're sharing the stage, but there's a fight, you know, there's a fight with these two instruments, and it's a really nice precursor that, you know, to what's going to come.
I think often men say they like, you know, strong, progressive, independent women, you know. But often I think they can say that just to sound progressive. And I think the reality of being a man is often, you know, and then having that reality in front of you is a real challenge to you. And I think James plays that really well, that you know, that moment of realizing, actually, this is, you know, this is someone who is all those things which I might say I had treasure and want in a woman, and here it is. But the reality is that it's not a clean thing. It's, you know, there is a real person in front of you, and while they are those things, they're also other things, because we are multitudes. And
yeah. Justin, what were the circumstances that meant that you also had to DOP your own film?
Well, we were prepping our small crew of heads of departments in the few days, you know, running up to the shoot. And I was going to use a great guy I'd known from Memphis. I do some jurying at the Indie Memphis Festival, which is a great festival, anyone submitting anywhere in the US. And he'd just done some great stuff. And I just wanted someone to collaborate with from that perspective. I'd mostly shot my films before, apart from the last short. I really wanted that experience of having that with a DP. Wasn't an experience I've really had working with someone in and out on that. And also knowing from a technical standpoint, I just wanted someone else on set for the teaching experience, you know, of that, to sort of, to be able to take the lead on certain things and, you know, so that the teaching could be overseen too. But then Ryan arrived from the US to Heathrow, and they detained him and deported him within 24 hours. So they kept him. They gave him a cheese sandwich and a glass of water. And they deemed that he was there, you know, to work. And he wasn't really, he was doing this as a favor, really, as like a holiday. I suppose, you know, whichever line you draw as to what is work and what isn't, they deemed it that he was there to work, and they sent him back. So we had a quick decision to make, and the only realistic decision was me doing it. But we found another guy locally who had a lot of experience with the cameras I was using, doing, you know, setting up lights and just sort of doing that. And he knew the university well, and so he was able to sort of engage with the students really well. So we had a bit of a nice buffer in another guy called Ryan. So we replaced one Ryan for another. But yeah, I ended up DPing, which sort of changed the film in lots of ways. I mean, there's another version of Wilderness out there that we'll never see, and would have been very different. But I think what we took away from this it lent itself quite well to certain scenarios, like the scene I was talking about earlier, where they're sort of fighting and you know, trying to have sex. That is just me and them. You know, there's no one else, and so there's no loss of translation in terms of what I wanted to capture and them. So I think we gained a lot from that, and we probably lost a lot too. But what we lost, we'll never really know.
Well, look, guys, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Let's remind people then, how can people see Wilderness?
People can see Wilderness on various streaming platforms, including Amazon and iTunes.
And Sky and Google and BT.
It just gives me to say thank you very much for giving us your time on the Britflix podcast.
Thanks for having us so much, Stuart.
Yeah, real pleasure. Really nice conversation. Thank you.
Big money at Menards. Gorilla tapes, glues, and adhesives are perfect for jobs around the house, indoors and out. Gorilla Heavy Duty Construction Adhesive has a 100% waterproof formula that provides a secure bond on any surface. From trim work to landscape block to hanging mirrors, it's all purpose and holds in 30 seconds. Pick it up for your project and head to Menards.com to see all of our great deals going on now.
Save big money at Menards.
Hey y'all, Darius Rucker here. You know, a lot of people ask me, what inspires your music? And one of the big things is a strong sense of place. That's why I love my home state of South Carolina and want to share the awesome things it has to offer. From the beautiful mountains down to the sunny coast, it's got it all. Not to mention two of my personal favorites, great golf and amazing food. Come see why I love this place. Visit DiscoverSouthCarolina.com.